morning. This is Lance Kenmore with the Kenmore team, and I'd like to welcome you to this week's edition of the Tri-Cities Real Estate Update. We're here every Saturday morning right here on News Talk 870. As always, you can contact me, Lance Kenmore, anytime direct on my cell phone at 727-8977 or visit us on the web at kenmoreteam.com. Once again, I always like to thank John for hosting and everybody here at the station for working to make this happen. John, how are you doing?
Well, you guys were talking about camping and trailers and other fun stuff, and then I was looking at the combined Dillon Harley baseball track schedule, and we're going to be living at the track and the baseball field.
Oh, yes, man. Absolutely. And you know what? And you bring that up. That is funny. You know, it gets warm for 2 weeks, and Tom and I start talking about camping and stuff and trailers, but there are quite a few sports families that I see grab those trailers, pull them into the parking lots for the weekends, and set up camp right out there where you're talking about, McKay.
Well, we're not that extreme.
But. you turn around one day and you'll get there. Mm-hmm. So, yep, it is definitely that time of year for sure. And that is our expert in-house lender, Mr. Tom Coyne with Umpqua. Tom, how are you doing?
You know, I'm doing great. Like we were just talking about, I'm just getting excited for camping seasons around the corner. The weather is kind of like flirting with getting warmer, but then it's still kind of cold, but we're getting there.
Oh, absolutely. And it has just been open the floodgates on the real estate side of things. It gets warm like this, and a lot of people thinking about getting their homes on the market, some new inventory coming to market. And yeah, we have been absolutely just crazy, crazy busy. So we always kind of like to start off. We're always keeping an eye on our local real estate news. And just a point of notation, if you are kind of leaving Tri-Cities on 82 out there, as you go by Queensgate and the Home Depot and Walmart out there in South Richland, you'll notice the dozers and everything moving dirt again, and new $9 million hotel going in there behind the Home Depot and by the new Fairchild Cinema out there. So we continue to see, you know, huge amount of growth. Love to see that type of investment. It's a chain out of Utah that is building that Northwest chain. And so really nice to see big, large projects like that still cranking away here in the Tri-Cities. So exciting to see that movement and a lot of new things still coming in the pipeline here with real estate in the Tri-Cities.
Well, you see something like that, you know, not only do you have to have workers that come in and actually work on the project, but then you also have to have employees to run it. So it's bringing more jobs here, and if they're building hotels, there must be a need for it. So people must be coming to Tri-Cities.
Yeah, absolutely. And you always look at some of our big weekends that we have. We have our Waterfallies weekends that come along. We've got these sports, large scales. We were just talking about sports. I mean, we have a lot of friends from college in Seattle and Portland area, and they're always coming over and visiting because their kids are at a softball tournament or a volleyball tournament or a soccer tournament. So, you know, we get a lot of travel and activities like that through here, and so it's going to be nice to have some brand new options, some really nice options coming along. So one of the things that happens in a great real estate market like we've had, and part of it is fantastic. The other part makes me chuckle a little bit. But one of the things that happens when you hear about how great the real estate market is and how the market is doing and houses selling quickly is you look around and all of a sudden you notice there's a lot of people that want to get into real estate. A lot of people start calling me. What does it take to become a real estate agent? What do we need to do to be a realtor? And so Tom and I were talking back and forth, and we said, gosh, have we ever done a show that really breaks down how you got to that point? What are some of the requirements that you have to do what you do? And what does that look like for somebody that might be getting into the business? And so both of us were like, oh, I can't believe we haven't done that. And this will be a great topic to talk about. So one of the things I did as I was getting ready for the show is I went to our National Association of Realtors. We call it NAR for short. And I just, every 2 years, they do a member report of what exactly it looks like to be a realtor. And so they look at their members and they look at the averages. And so I thought, first of all, as a baseline, I would cover a little bit of what some of of those characteristics of realtors are and the business activity that they're involved in. And so last year's report, 2015, really focused on 14's data, and then they're in the current process of producing a new report. But here's what we were looking at. So it's really interesting that the typical realtor has 12 years of experience. So I was very glad to see that, to see what the profile looked like. So typical realtor has 12 years of experience. 18% of the members have at least one personal assistant. And then it was interesting because this number just kind of shocked me. I mean, I would absolutely be starving if this was my number. But in 2015, the typical agent had 11 transactions. Was all they had, and that is an interesting number. We kind of operate as a different model. We'll talk about models and brokerages later. But the typical agent had 11 transactions.
When I hear that, I think of the person who is maybe like a stay at home mom, and she kind of sells real estate on the side a little bit if you need her to.
Yeah, and absolutely. And that's a thing about our industry, and that's one reason I wanted to do the show today. Is a lot of people transition into the business that way. Maybe they've decided to do this part-time. I'm not saying I advocate that, but you're exactly right. Because when we look at barriers to entry, as opposed to, you know, like say a restaurant where you got to buy a location and buy equipment and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, that's not the case to become a realtor. So lower barriers of entry. And so you're exactly right. When we look at those averages, there might be some people out there that do this part-time versus some people that do it full time, or in my case, I think I'm going to say more than full time,
ultra time.
So, but the average breaks down to 11 transactions. So, one of the things that makes me really proud is when I even take a look at our team, and we function a little bit different. And I look at my agents and our average last year alone, even if you include some of our licensed assistants, is our agents on our team are averaging over 40 transactions. So, the experience level in 2 years, they've got four times the experience level of the average agent. So that was interesting to look at that. So you can typically count on the statistics being 11 transactions. Now, this was an interesting number, which we don't see in this area as often, is that 46% of residential brokerage specialists had at least one transaction that was a foreclosure. And so, and I went back and looked at our numbers, and we did have some foreclosures, but they were for our buyers. They were not representing sellers. So our buyers had bought some foreclosed properties in Tri-Cities. Very rare comparison to a conventional sale. But across the board, you do find that almost 30% of agents were in a transaction that involved that.
I think that number will probably go down.
Yeah.
As we keep kind of moving forward, the numbers of foreclosures have certainly gone down, and they might continue to go down with tighter and tighter regulations. But that is interesting. That would be a higher number than I would expect.
Yeah, it was. I was a little surprised when I saw that because we don't run across it that often. And then obviously, if you're thinking about getting in the business, the median gross income of realtors was $45,800 in 2014. So $45,000 as the median income there. And if we demographically just look, and the typical realtor is a 57-year-old white female who had attended some college and is a homeowner. That is your average typical realtor. So I do qualify for the homeowner portion, not the 57-year-old.
You don't fit into that box perfectly.
I don't fit into that box very well, but that is typical. So one of the things that people always ask is, gosh, what are the requirements to get a broker's license? And that is a difference that happened 4 or 5 years ago that is confusing to some of the public and the listeners. So another reason I'm excited to do this show is that the most basic level of real estate license in the state of Washington is actually called a broker license. It used to be called real estate salesperson. And then the realtor designation that most people know us as realtors is what you get when you join the National Association of Realtors, which is a trade organization for our industry that has a higher level of standards that, we comply with, and that our local MLS is a requirement to be a part of to be involved in that. So you have to be so it is now called broker. So the state changed that because there was confusion in the industry. I personally think in a lot of the requirements that they made with the changes are way better. Additional educational requirements, additional supervision of new licensees requirements that came out. However, I do think it made it confusing for the public because generally they're like, I want to talk to your broker, meaning I want to talk to the owner
the
of that company.
Yeah.
So what they did now is the real estate, the lowest level of the license is called broker. Then there is generally a managing broker, and that's who supervises the brokers. And then the owner of that specific branch in general is then called the DB, which is the designated broker. And many times the designated broker and the managing broker are the same person. If it's an independent company like our company is at Kenmore Team, we have that set up. So to qualify to get the lowest level to get your real estate license in the state of Washington, you have to be at least 18 years old. So once you turn 18, you're able to go out and get your real estate license. You have to have a high school diploma or equivalent, and then you have to complete, it's a 90-hour clock hour course, 90 hours of approved real estate education within 2 years before applying to take your exam. And that education includes a 60-hour course in real estate fundamentals and a 30-hour course in real estate practices. Once you've completed that, then you're allowed to make your appointment and take your state broker's exam. Another question I'm getting a lot from people calling our office and talking to us is, what is the cost to do this? What do I need to do? One of the courses that a lot of our new agents will go through, or our licensed assistants and staff that we have them go through, we tend to like to use the Rockwell Institute. It's an online course that you can take. And so I looked up, did a little research from that their website before coming down the radio show. That pre-license package that gets you the fundamentals textbook, the online course, and practice exams is $489. And then it ends up being about $200 for you to go take the test once you schedule your test. So that really is the basics of getting started. So you're looking at those 90 hours. They're kind of work at your own pace. You can also do this. Sometimes they offer live classes. Most have gone to an online format, though. Work at your own pace. Finish the classes. Take the test courses, and then go ahead and schedule your actual broker's exam. Interesting to note, the Rockwell Institute, their website says that they have a national pass rate of 80%. And the state's pass rate from students taking their course is 91%. So pretty successful ratios there of people that have gone through that course and then passed the test. So it was interesting to log on and see that. Now, if you want to be active in the real estate business, so you can take this course to get prepared. Maybe you're wanting to do something in a year or two, and then you can leave your license inactive. But if you want it to be active and be able to sell real estate, you then have to hang your license underneath, which we talked about earlier, a designated broker in the state of Washington. So then you have to find an agency where you can have your license at and then work under that agency's brokerage. And so we're going to talk when we come back from the break a little bit more about that process, those brokerage models, and then we're going to quiz Tom a little bit about the requirements of getting into his industry.
Right here on News Talk 870.
Welcome Welcome back to the Tri-Cities Real Estate Update. We've been talking a little bit about our industry. What does it take to become a real estate agent? What are some of the licensing requirements? What does the state say about that? And we also went over some of the basic stats of what a realtor looks like nationally, roughly what they earn income-wise, because a lot of people look around and say, hey, this might be a great career, might be a great first career, might be a great second career. I haven't even started to talk about my thoughts on that. We've just kind of gone over the information today. But there's a lot. We did briefly touch on the fact that it is a profession that has a lower barrier to entry than some other professions. You talk about we talked about a 90-hour clock hour course, taking your broker's license test, and then hanging your license. I've seen a lot of people. I've seen people do it in 2 weeks, and I've seen people take, 3 months to get that done. But really, if you stuck to it, I mean, within 3 weeks to a month, you can be licensed and ready to go to work in the industry. Now, the whole other side of the coin of that is we talked about median income of $45,000 for a realtor. How many transactions it takes to make that work. And one of the things that broker test does not prepare you for is the sales industry. It teaches you the fundamentals about real estate, the knowledge about real estate, but then you have to go out and find clients and find people that are wanting to transact and offer your services and marketing. It's really interesting because none of those factors are in the preparation for the test. And so you look at there's a massive skill set, and that's where you go, how am I going to get trained on that? Am I going to work in a paid position as somebody's assistant for a couple of years? Am I going to go straight into the sales, commission only? What type of brokerage am I going to work at? So there's a lot to talk about. And I take a lot of calls from people out there that are considering it. I'm always very open to talk to people about how I did it, what my path looked like. And I had a mentorship type setup where I was working under another very successful agent for a time period. And then he helped me transition into a sales position and then from there into a managing broker's position. So I'm always open to tell people that here's how I went about that process. Here's where I think I screwed it up, because there's some things along the way going back I would do it differently. And then some things that I think were done great, and I would recommend the same to others. So we talk about that a lot, but I want to kind of see a little bit how that compares to the lending industry. Tom, we work so close together on deals and stuff. And, as we prepared for the show, I actually was super excited because, I know how good you are and how much experience you have. But I looked back and I thought, I don't know much about what it exactly takes that got you to that point. So I'm going to turn it over to you for a little while, and I'm just going to sit back here and learn something.
Lance, you probably remember me when I was 18 years old working at a bank. I don't know if I can say the name, so I'm just not going to.
Yeah.
I was a teller.
I remember because it was on the corner of Columbia Center Boulevard by Columbia Center Mall. So I think we know which one that is.
Okay, perfect. So yeah, I was a teller there, and it took me 7 months or so, and I was promoted to personal banker, and I started doing home loans. And so I was 19 years old at that time, and I stayed there for about a year, and I found out kind of through you that, I can make a lot more elsewhere, basically.
Yes.
Certain banks hire their loan officers more as service people, but if you're more of a salesman and less of service, then you maybe should be working somewhere else, because a lot of companies drive you or pay you based off of your drive and your willingness to go out and go get deals. But I actually then went to a mortgage brokerage, and I was there for 6 years. I really kind of credit that time for really fine-tuning my skills and building my business and my business systems, everything that was going to make me successful, and we did really well there. But I got to the point where I just wasn't ever going to go to that next level. And that level I was at was fantastic, but I knew it could be more. And so I went to go work for Sterling Bank, who at that time I thought was the absolute best lender in town. And then we were merged with Umpqua, and kind of the rest is history. So that was my path in getting to where I'm at. But every bank's a little bit different. So I thought I would talk about the different ways of getting into the industry and then all the requirements. So first off is some of the banks and credit unions around here look at a loan officer as a service position where they don't care to be the number one lender in town. They just want to service the clients that they have. So if you walk into your credit union and say, I want a loan, you're going to go meet with Bob, and Bob is just a service. So he gets paid a salary, and it really doesn't matter if he closes one loan or 20 loans. He just gets paid what he gets paid. So they look at that as a service perspective. And then you have a bank like Umpqua who wants you to go out and get as many loans as you can. And they're going to pay you the more loans you get, the more you're going to make, basically. But the rules and regulations that loan officers have to follow vary from the different companies that are out there. And mortgage brokerages and correspondent lenders have different state and federal requirements than a bank like we do have, with us being FDIC and funding our own loans. So I just want to talk about the rules that Umpqua has and the requirements we have, because those are the ones I'm familiar with. First, every loan officer out there has to register with the National Mortgage Licensing System to receive what's called their NMLS number. This is a unique number that identifies each loan officer, and it's the number that's placed on every loan application they take to determine who originated that loan. Now, at the time of signing up with the NMLS, every loan officer must pass a criminal and credit background check before they're issued this number. And then they have to attest to that information every year, so it's kind of updated yearly. Now, at Umpqua, we have to take continuing education classes, and these are sponsored by the bank. So what I love is I don't have to go out to some third-party company and get these classes. The bank issues these for you, and they tell you when they're due. But every quarter, there's, I want to say, 6 to 8 courses that we have to take. And some of the examples are the basics of HMDA, ethics and trust, Reg Z, Reg B, every reg that's out there. You got to take all of them. Safety, best practices with social media, loan estimates, closing disclosures. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. But these courses are designed to keep our originators, employees up to date on all the laws, regulations, and rules, and all the other important information we need to know about. Now, this is really important because what you learned 5 years ago may not apply at all today. The industry is always changing, some for the good and some, well, I'll just say that some of these laws that are being made out there aren't made by people who are actually in the industry.
Absolutely.
So, or carbon-based life units.
I would agree with that on the real estate side.
So they're not always the best for the client, as they're intended to be. But our job is to make sure they're always operating within these parameters and within these laws, and then try to make it as easy as possible for our clients. And unfortunately, many of the laws and rules that we have to follow are not really conducive to that. But at Umpqua, as far as pay structure goes, our loan officers are paid a percentage of the total loan amounts that they close monthly. Now, certain companies out there allow their originators to structure their own pay, meaning that if they want to get paid X percentage, they charge the client enough to get paid that percentage. Or if they want to get paid less, then the client pays less. But at Umpqua, what I really like is that the loan officer is going to get paid the same amount, same percentage on every file, regardless of the loan program, regardless of the interest rate, regardless of the closing costs. So there is no vested interest in the loan officer to put them into one program over the next, because they're going to get paid the same amount no matter what. So I really like that for the client. And not all banks operate that way. And some are different. You might just have to, if you're out there shopping around, ask them how they get paid. And some companies out there just pay their loan officers a salary. So the banks that I think pay their loan officer's salary are the banks that look at that position as more of a service, customer service position, than a sales position. But the problem is, for the consumer, if you're a good loan officer, you're not going to work at a company like that, because the potential for you to make more money elsewhere by getting paid commission, I mean, it's a lot better for the good loan officer to go work for another company who's going to pay him commission. And
it's more of an incentive. It's an incentive to do a good job.
And real estate sales are very basically on that same type of setup, where we're paid a percentage. I'm going to talk a little bit about the splits at the end of Tom's segment for sure.
So if you go to a company that just pays their loan officer salary, I kind of look at those loan officers as more just in like training almost, because as soon as they feel comfortable and confident to go out and get paid strictly commission, they're going to do that because they're going to get paid so much more money. So it's going to be different for every company that's out there, and I can't tell you which ones pay which, because I just don't think that's appropriate. But every bank pays a little bit differently. So why Umpqua? You know, for the clients, our goal is just to make it easier for you. We want you to end the transaction and say, geez, that went easier than I ever thought it could. And so when you hear someone who went to another bank telling you their nightmare loan story, they say, well, you should have went with Tom at Umpqua. And for all the loan officers out there, Umpqua, we just want to make it easy for you, too. There's no overlays. So whatever Fannie Mae, Freddie Mae, FHA, VA asks for, that's what we're going to require. And that means that we will approve more clients than some of the other banks out there because we don't have added rules on top of the set guidelines from these main regulatory agencies. We have a very competitive compensation structure, and I think what we have is the best support staff out there. So our processors, funders, underwriters, they're fantastic. So we just flat out close loans. Lance, I guess I'll just say I don't think there's a better place out there for me or my clients than Umpqua Bank.
Well, that's awesome, Tom, and I really appreciate that segment. And, you know, we get to know who your staff is and who your other loan officers are over there. And we love interacting with them, and they do a fantastic job. So I know you have that culture over there that would be exciting for somebody looking to get in the industry or make that leap for mm-hmm. sure. So that is really, really good information. And one of the things you brought up, and I'm glad I wrote some notes as you were talking there as I was listening to that, and that was structuring pay and how real estate agents get paid. And one of the things that is confusing sometimes is the cost of selling a home. You know, we've broken down how much it costs to sell a home. And one of the things that happens a lot of times is there's a little bit of sticker shock there with some people when they go to sell a home and they're dealing with an agent and says that it is, you know, 5, 6, or 7% to sell the house. So one of the things I thought I'd go over is how that breakdown really works. And when you're a seller, that commission really gets broken up four different ways. And I think that's what's always not explained very well to people. So for instance, when you're talking to that seller and you say, let's just use an example, you say we're going to use 6% as the commission. And you're talking to that seller, the first thing that happens is 3% of that actually goes to the listing firm, the person that is talking to you right there, because what they're doing is they're taking a percentage. It doesn't have to be equal split, but for the purpose of this example, we'll say they take an equal split. They're keeping 3 on their side for the agent, the listing, the marketing, getting the house prepared to sell, and then they're taking that other 3%. And they're offering that as the incentive for the other 600 agents in the Tri-Cities to bring their buyer. And that's how real estate agents that are working with buyers get paid. The seller is taking a portion of that and offering it to all those agents, say, hey, bring your buyers here, make an offer on our property, and then we will pay you as representing that client. We'll pay you 3% for that service. So immediately 3% goes off to the other brokerage. 3% comes into the brokerage of the agent that you're working with. And then likely what happens inside that brokerage, say they're at Kenmore Team or Coldwell, Windermere, Remax, that agent then has a split with that brokerage. So for the advertising of the brokerage, for the copier, for the phones, for the desk where they work at, they're then taking that 3%, and we'll just once again do 50% to make it easy. The agent's taking 1.5%. And then the brokerage is taking 1.5% for errors and omissions insurance policies, oversight, education, all of that. So at the end of that transaction, because what I hear so often in the news and the media and stuff, it's like, oh my gosh, 6%, this is crazy. All the agents will be driving Lamborghinis, you know, and Ferraris, you know. But it's not like that agent that is there in front of you, they're not taking that 6% home. Generally, you know, maybe they're 1.5% or 2%, which, don't get me wrong, is still a lot of money. But then when you look at the median income of the realtor being $45,000, now you can start to see how that is possible in that scenario. Because trust me, if they were getting 6% of all 11 to 15 transactions mm-hmm. they were doing, that number would be way, way higher. But there's business overhead expenses that get paid out of that, a split with the brokerages, and that's how that ends up being the pay structure of those agents. So another trendy thing to talk about, and that's another thing that led to my category about this, is there's a lot of companies, technology related, being a part of it, that is trying to change that model. That says, you know what, that's still a ridiculous number, the 6%, and I just want the house to be listed on the MLS. I'll deal with all the offers. I'll deal with all the inquiries. I'll do my own advertising. And I surely don't want to pay that amount. So right now, there's a big movement in real estate similar to what happened in, say, the travel agency and some other industries 5 or 6 years ago, where there's new technology platforms coming up that are trying to make that process easier and, in the end, lower the cost to the consumer. Good, bad, or indifferent, it will be interesting to see how this plays out. We're paying very, very close attention to that because I think in our industry already in the last 4 to 5 years, we have adopted technologies and digital signatures and home tours and drone tours. We have adopted technologies that I think make us way better today than we were 5 or 6 years ago. So there's this debate of, are we way better and still deserve a higher amount, or should the technology be used to lower the standard of service and you pay less? I think depending upon your particular situation and your need, there's going to be room for both models in the industry. There just has to be. So it comes down to what you need at this particular time, and it also comes down to experience level. One of the stats that I was going to cover that I didn't cover before the break was realtors with 16 years of experience, which I'm at 17, I think, last time I checked. I was saying 15 for like 5 years, and my wife is finally like, stop, it's been 4 years. You got to change that number. So I'm around 17, 18 years of being licensed there. And those agents had a median income of nearly $70,000 versus the median agent that was at $45,000. So what happens over that time, too, is you just start to pick up those traits. More people seek you out. You have more referrals. Think of it now as when you first start out. Who's going to refer you business because they're happy with you? Well, you haven't made anybody happy yet. So those first 2-3 years are really difficult because it's all brand new to you. Fast forward, if you can stay in the business to that 7, 8, 9, 10 year mark, what's happening now is the people that you sold houses to 10 years ago, if you've stayed in contact with them, treated them well, given them updates, now you're just waking up in the morning and those people are starting to call you because they're moving. So on top of your new business that you've been getting, you're now starting to double up with all of your referrals that are coming. And if you sell at a really high level, it's like one of those snowballs that just gets bigger and bigger on every roll, because now the power of that multiplication towards the end, say 25, 26 years, tons and tons of referral business. And that's what we're always after. I know if you log on to Tom and I both store a lot of our reviews and stuff on Zillow. If you have any questions about the type of business that we do, please feel free to go to Zillow. Check out Tom's lender profile. Check out Kenmore Team's profile there. And you'll see and hear from neighbors in the community on that type of stuff that we're doing. Because our goal is to, you know, continually make that snowball bigger and bigger. We've had to upgrade and hire staff along the way to help us deal with those number of referrals. And honestly, the way we're set up now, I wouldn't want to go back to how I used to do it. We're so specialized now and providing such a higher level of service. It is absolutely a blast to do it and having a great time doing it.
Well, Lance, you really nailed it. You know, as you continue to develop your business and time goes on, the business grows and it will continue to grow. And one thing that I think we both really focus on is that you don't want to let the service sacrifice because you don't have as much time because you have higher volume. So I think we've both done a really good job at adapting to maintaining and continuing to grow that volume while keeping the service levels as good or even better than we used to expect.
So if you have any questions about getting into the industry, please go to our website, kenmoreteam.com. Shoot us a message. We'll get you to either one of us. Tom just summed it up extremely well. I could not sum it up any better. This is a topic I could talk hours about. McKay is like giving me the signal that we're over time already. So I'm going to cut it off. We are going to be right back here next week, though,
right here on News Talk 870.